The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, why did the scientific revolution come about when it did? Why could previous generations not make the great strides made during the Enlightenment? And why is the scientific revolution still a cause for debate, even today? We speak to David Wootton, whose new account of the scientific revolution challenges the notion that all knowledge is culturally relative and truth is simply consensus. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. David Wootton is Anniversary Professor of History at the University of York. His new book, The Invention of Science, seeks to tell the story of the revolution that gave birth to modern science and challenge the prevailing orthodoxy of this history. David, this must have been an epic task. You draw on a huge amount of material, including Latin texts, and it's a controversial topic in some ways. What prompted you to write it?
In 2006, I wrote a book called Bad Medicine, which was about the delayed progress in medicine, about the fact that for thousands of years, doctors had done more harm than good, and tried to ask why did medicine in the 19th century start to actually save lives rather than kill people. And consequently, it was a book about progress. And all the historians of medicine said, you shouldn't be in employment. You're talking about progress. Historians aren't allowed to talk about progress. They literally put this in print. This man should not be employed in a university. So I'm a sort of cantankerous person, and when people tell me I shouldn't do things, I tend, if they're legal and if I think they're appropriate, to do them over again. And I sat down and started doing it over again. I wrote a book on Galileo in the meantime to really get up to speed. And when I felt I was going fast enough, I wrote this book.
What was so controversial about progress?
Historians have reached a mutual agreement that you cannot talk about progress because this is to say that our culture is better than other cultures. And this is an unacceptable thing to say. And it's to imply that history has a purpose or a goal. And of course, history doesn't. I don't think history has a purpose or a goal. That's true. I don't think in general our culture is necessarily better than others, though I think in some ways, getting rid of slavery, giving women the vote, it is better than others. But science is a very particular case, because in the case of science, there really is progress. It's the only thing in human culture where you can genuinely claim a pattern of progress. And then the question is, where does progress begin and what makes it possible? And those are the questions my book sets out to answer.
Why is the scientific revolution itself still a topic of debate even today? And why is it important for us to have a sort of more sophisticated understanding of it?
Well, there's a circle here. If you say there can't be any progress, then there can't be a scientific revolution. And so you have to turn around and say there wasn't a scientific revolution. You've got yourself into a logjam, I think, mentally. There's another sort of small problem, the sort of small problem that historians worry about and ordinary people don't and shouldn't, I think, which is the word revolution is fundamentally a late 18th century word. And we're talking here about the 17th century. So people in the 17th century don't say they want to make a revolution in science. They say they want to make a reformation in science, or they want to make a new beginning in science, or they want to tear down the old building and start again, or they want to throw the rubbish away. They have all sorts of ways of saying it. But they're talking about what we call a revolution in science, and that's our language, and there's no reason why we shouldn't use it.
And again, why is it important for us to have a kind of more sophisticated understanding of the scientific revolution?
Well, I think it's difficult to describe how important it is that we should understand what science is. Science has made our world. I mean, this is obviously true of the 20th and 21st century world, the late 19th century world. But actually, one of the arguments of the book is that it's true of the Industrial Revolution, that since the 18th century, science has been transforming our world, and we live in a world made by science. And so we need to understand what science is. And it is a unique achievement of, let's say, Western civilization, for want of a better term. It's a unique achievement of Western civilization to gain increasing mastery over nature, and to have that rapidly develop and continuously develop. What's fundamental here, in a sense, is the very idea of progress comes from science. People don't talk about progress, don't believe in progress, until they start talking about progress in science. By the middle of the 18th century, people are saying the whole of human history is a history of progress. Nobody had thought that before, and nobody thinks that before Newton. The scientists invent progress.
How was it that what we now see as the great thinkers of the 17th and 18th centuries were the ones able to make these great strides rather than previous generations?
That's a very deep and powerful question. If I can answer it quickly, I'll be a genius. I spent a lot of time reading a medieval philosopher called Oresme, who's a genius. He's incredibly clever. It's not that people before the 17th century can't think and think with enormous sophistication. It's that what you get in the 17th century is certain new tools for thinking, certain new attitudes about what's involved in thinking, and a new cultural context to think in. So let's take the new tools for thinking. I mean, the beginning of all this, I would argue, is the invention of the concept of discovery, which takes place during the Portuguese voyages of exploration, where people first start using the word descobrir in Portuguese. First appears, I think, probably ever in print in Amerigo Vespucci's description of his voyage to America. And out of that, it spreads into all the European languages. And discovery is different. You know, we think Archimedes cried, Eureka, and by that he meant, I've made a discovery. Eureka means I've found the answer. I've found the answer to a problem. What Archimedes already knew before he got into his bath, that the water rose in his bath. What he's had is a moment of insight. What happens when Columbus discovers America, when Amerigo Vespucci discovers that it's a continent, is the recognition that there's a major piece of information that the ancients didn't have, and that this piece of information is fundamentally incompatible with all sorts of things that have passed for true for a very long time. And this is the moment at which new information, which they tend to use, they call what they use is experience. New information is seen as shaping knowledge and enabling you to have knowledge that's unquestionably true. And the result is people who've been arguing since Aristotle about questions. Why is it that when you throw a javelin, the javelin keeps moving after it's left your hand? It's a fundamental problem in Aristotelian physics. All sorts of debates, all sorts of alternatives. Nobody ever resolves that question. They simply go through a set of alternative positions and debate them. After Galileo, there's an answer to the question. After Newton, there's an answer to the question. Debates begin to be closed down for the first time, and they're closed down by experiments, by new information, by discoveries.
So Columbus arriving on the edge of America gives rise to this word discovery, in a sense, that then gives...
Columbus never knows what he's done. Vespucci knows what he's done. And
because he can't express it.
Well, because he doesn't know it's a new continent. He still thinks it's Asia. Vespucci knows it's a new continent. And that knowledge gets transferred to Waldseemüller and his great map of 1507, which comes with a little text in which he outlines that what's been done here is people have found things that were never known before. This is a sort of phrase you get running through, because in Latin, there is no word for discovery. Very briefly, the word enters the Latin language and drops out again, because good humanists won't use it, because it's not in the language of Cicero and so on. But find things that have never been known before. That's what's happening with Columbus. And it sets in motion a culture where people say, everything that has been that can be known is not yet known. I'm more or less quoting here from a 16th century text. Everything that can be known is not yet known. We need to know more. We mustn't assume that the ancients... The assumption before that is you find out things by reading books. It's all somehow there in an old book if you look for it. Suddenly the claim is being made that you have to go out and look at the world. And the people who engaged in this enterprise of going out and look at the world in a new way are all of them, nearly all of them, mathematicians, because they're the people who have this interface with navigation, with surveying, with ballistics, all sorts of applied technologies. So they're the people who see how you can put new information to work in the world.
How far does this point go that at that time, prior to Columbus arriving in America, people thought that all knowledge was already sort of known and could be found in these ancient texts? Because surely people were walking around then not thinking that the answers to say, consciousness or the answers to, you know, the structure of the solar system were all written down. Maybe the solar system, they did think that was all written down and they had some sort of pre-Copernican sort of concept of that. But did they think that everything that could be known was known?
Yeah. Oh, they say this. And then you get people after Columbus saying, now for the first time we can see that everything that can be known. People actually write in which they say explicitly, Aristotle did not know everything that could be known. And this is a contentious claim. And they make it with regard to things like where does the Danube originate? Aristotle didn't know the answer to this question. And in that sense, it's just a shattering realization that everything that can be known hasn't already been found. And that there are new things to be known.
It must have been incredibly sort of destabilizing in a sense for them, or unnerving perhaps, if maybe it suddenly dawns on them, maybe it didn't dawn on them how little they knew or how little humanity had known in the past. Yeah. But
it's a slow process. I mean, Copernicus, when he decides that classical astronomy isn't all right, he tells us what he does. He goes off and reads old books. He's still engaged in it. He doesn't do virtually any new astronomical observations. He's still engaged in a process where he thinks that if he can find an ancient Greek who said something different, that will give him the key to finding the right answer. He finds Aristarchus of Samoa and Samos and things like that. So then in that sense, Copernicus hasn't yet crossed the threshold. He wants to rejig old knowledge and reformulate it. And that's how he's read by his contemporaries. He's not in the business of starting fundamentally from scratch with something radically new.
You talk about this debate around whether it's possible to establish reliable knowledge. And by reliable knowledge, do you mean information that sort of can withstand cultural change?
Let me start with what I think I was talking about. I want a moment to think about that question. Gilbert, when he published his book on magnetism in 1600, says, I'm going to demonstrate to you what magnets are and how they work. And then he has to give you a glossary in which he explains that he's using the word demonstrate. He's writing Latin, but demonstratio. He's using this word in a new way with a new meaning. He doesn't mean in the way that a geometrician or mathematician does a mathematical demonstration. He says, it's as if I'm going to show you with my finger what's happening. I'm going to point to it. This is reliable knowledge in the sense that if you do the experiment yourself, you'll see that I'm right. You can repeat what I've done, and you'll discover that you get the same results as I do. It's an invention of replication, you might say. I think one of the interesting and puzzling things about science, to go back to the way you put the question, is that the sort of knowledge that Gilbert establishes about magnets is still reliable knowledge 500 years later, and yet in many ways our culture has fundamentally transformed. Much of the knowledge that Galileo establishes about astronomy, for example, almost all of it is still reliable knowledge of 400 years later. So in that sense, I think one of the peculiar things and remarkable things about science is that it survived a lot of cultural change. And that's because by the 1660s and 1670s, the terms in which you do science get set. And since then, what we know has changed enormously. Darwinism would be a simple example. But the way in which we think we go about knowing things has remained fundamentally unchanged since the 1660s and 70s, and we are still continuously in that culture. It's the culture of Newton, as far as our understanding of what the scientific enterprise is. So I would argue that it's really very surprising how stable scientific culture has been since the 1660s and 70s, given that the content of science has been absolutely radically transformed.
Tell us about relativism and where that comes into this story.
Relativism is a very, very slippery word. And I suppose if I were to start rewriting my book from the very beginning, I think one of the things I would do is start by talking more about the different meanings of the word and the different ways in which you can use it. It's a straightforward principle of anthropology, for example, that you take each culture in its own terms. It's just become a straightforward principle of history that you study each period of the past in its own terms. And therefore, you don't import into the past your sense of what's important. You try and find out what was important for them. So in that sense, relativism has become a methodological principle of anthropology, sociology, history. And in certain respects, it's a necessary principle, but I think it has limits for understanding processes that people are not fully conscious of at the time, but are fundamentally important. nobody understood what was going to happen in the French Revolution. But if you want to work out how you get to Napoleon, then you're going to have to ask questions that people at the time weren't asking and didn't have answers to if you're going to understand change. The great problem, one of the great problems about relativism, I want to argue, is that it makes understanding of change impossible because people are never conscious of the processes that bring change about. Change is never always deliberate. So that's one issue. Second issue behind relativism, you might say, is postmodernism and the notion that all things are open to different interpretations and there's no correct interpretation. And the deeper sort of philosophical tradition that lies behind that that's particularly interested historians of and philosophers of science is Wittgenstein and the notion that you can, as it were, choose your own rules of the game. Make up your own intellectual language games and play them your own way. And there's no right or wrong about that. Now, if you apply that attitude to science, which is what a whole group of our sociologists and historians of science set out to do, then you assume there's no such thing as bad science. And that's a fundamental principle of what's called the strong program. The strong program says we're going to interpret successful arguments and unsuccessful arguments in exactly the same way. So if I find someone who believes that the Earth is flat, I'm going to say, well, very peculiar. Why do they believe this? Are they psychologically disturbed? Have they never read a modern book? You know, what's wrong with them? So if I find someone who believes that the Earth is round and rotates around the sun, I'm going to ask exactly the same questions. What psychologically, what socially has made this happen to them? And I won't simply say, well, they know more than the other person. I will ask exactly the same sorts of questions. And this is called, you know, this is a principle of symmetry. We'll treat them alike. And of course, the fundamental assumption that there has to be is that there is no such thing as reality, which enables you to say, well, the person who believes that the Earth is round and goes around the sun is in touch with something, the real world, while the person who believes the Earth is flat isn't in touch with the real world. So you have to define reality out of the story. Now, if you define reality out of the story, you can't understand science. And if you define reality out of the story, then there's no such thing as progress because these are all things that we make up as we go along. And so you get a sociology and a history of science which says fundamentally that science is, the technical term is always constructed, but it's constructed out of nothing. Now, I strongly believe science is constructed. It's constructed out of various things, including what we would call evidence, but out of cultural concepts like discovery as well. But it's not constructed out of nothing. It's constructed out of an encounter with the world. And it's that encounter with the world that you need to study in order to study how science develops. So I'm what's called an active realist. I believe there's a real world out there, but we engage with it in on our own terms and in our own way. But we certainly don't, as it were, make it up. It's not a dream that we have, which is fundamentally the way in which most recent history of science has treated what scientists do, that they construct it out of nothing.
So some of those, maybe the hardliners on that side of this sort of enterprise would have seen what I might think of as robust scientific results as being a construction with no more validity than another result that says something else.
The famous book here is Chapin and Schaffer's Leviathan and the Air Pump, which argues that where the standard view was that Boyle was right to say he constructed a vacuum and he discovered Boyle's law, Hobbes, who said, nonsense, you've discovered nothing, you don't know what you're talking about, had equally good or better arguments on his side. So in that sense, what they precisely wanted to do was take away the presumption or the understanding, correct understanding, that Boyle had got somewhere and say, on the contrary, his arguments are as defective as those of his opponents and he's not actually getting anywhere. Now, I think this is just wrong. Boyle had clearly got somewhere, working out where he got to and how he got there and what makes it possible. It's a complicated problem. The puzzle is that for 40 years, historians of science have fundamentally stopped tackling that problem. They've stopped asking, how did scientists learn to make progress in science? How did scientists learn to get the whole scientific enterprise underway? And the result is, I think, we know more about the history and philosophy of science, really, than we did when Kuhn wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in 1962.
Presumably a lot of that thinking doesn't still persist among historians of science. Are you here to bury those guys, or do they not exist anymore?
They do exist. They hold chairs in Harvard and Cambridge. They run the profession. They're absolutely still there. The puzzle, I think, is that they are still there. you read the Chapin's introduction to the 30-year reissue of Leviathan and the Air Pump, he says, I'm surprised that this is still the classic book in the field. I think it's really astonishing. I think there's a strange intellectual limbo we've been in. And what's happened since the science wars and the SoCal hoax and so on is people have backed away from a lot of hardline statements of that position, but they haven't constructed an alternative position. So what you get is a sort of milk and water version and a sort of half-hearted version and a sort of, well, a bit of this and a bit of that. I'm a bit impatient with that. I think we actually need to think our way through a coherent way of talking about the history and philosophy of science, which would replace what I would call hardline relativism, the strong program. And I think what we're doing at the moment now, what most of the profession is doing, is just sort of stumbling around and making do without one. So yes, I'm here to bury that position in the process. You know, I come not to bury Caesar, but to praise him. I mean, we have to recognize a great deal of what was important about that. And I'm in many ways trying to follow on lines of argument that come out of that. But I do think we have to replace that by a fundamentally different approach.
Have you got that new approach? Have you got the answer?
I don't know. You know, you run an argument, and if it's got legs, it survives. And if it doesn't, it falls over, and then it's dead. And I'm perfectly happy, as it were. It's not my... You don't embark on something like this to get it right. You embark on something like this to have a good go at it. And try and raise the standard of the debate and to provoke other people to do better. And if the result is that somebody else says, no, you've done it all wrong, this is how you do it, that's perfectly fine with me.
One of the questions I had come to me when I said I was going to be chatting to you was, why the Greeks weren't scientists? Is the answer that they weren't doing methodical testing or something? Or why were they not considered scientists, or were they?
A part of the argument that is the most delicate. I think you can think you've broken my argument here. And I don't think it is a broken argument, but I think it's a delicate argument. As far as Galileo is concerned, in 1600, he wants to be another Archimedes. Now, I think that something happens around 1600 when Galileo reads Gilbert and he does his own experiments with hydrostatics, when he stops being like Archimedes. But there's absolutely no doubt that he starts out trying to be like Archimedes. So in that sense, there would be no modern science without the process of trying to imitate Archimedes. I don't want to take that away, because that would just be foolish. I do want to say that ancient Greek, the sort of science that Galileo admires in ancient Greeks, is fundamentally mathematical and geometrical and deductive, and it's based upon proofs. It's not based upon experimentation. It's not based upon the acquisition of new information. Aristotle does wonderful, extraordinary biology, but when William Harvey, the man who discovers the circulation of the blood, he says, I'm an Aristotelian. He's very clear. You can't rescue Harvey and turn him into something else. He's an Aristotelian. But when Harvey says, and the people before me who've done real studies of what we would now call biology, he doesn't have the word biology, but of natural processes, there's Aristotle, and he says, and there's Fallopio. That's it. It's a broken tradition, a tradition that for 1,500 years hasn't existed. Mm. What's striking about what happens after 1600 is you get a continuous tradition.
Can I come back to some of the language issues here? Because you talk about how the scientific revolution goes hand in hand, or was almost facilitated by changes in language. And what are some of the words that allowed this to happen, that fed into all of this?
This is where I started writing this book, and I still can't quite believe how powerful this line of thinking is. Started with the word fact. Chapin and Shaffer and Leviathan and the Air Pump say Boyle is making facts. And then there was a sort of literature that came out of that saying, well, where does this word fact come from, and who starts using it? Which I've tried to work on. And now, of course, with the internet and with the digitization of databases, you can pump in the word fact and find almost every example of someone using the word fact in print through the 16th and 17th centuries. The word fact in its modern usage suddenly becomes an epidemic in England in 1663. And you can trace back a very few usages before that, but hardly any. It's used before that in its modern sense, in French a bit, in Latin a bit. but it becomes the buzzword of the new science. So people come to England from Italy in the early 18th century, and they say, in England, all they talk about is facts. They're all about facts and facts and facts all the time. And this is because, and we just, we don't notice this because we use the word fact all the time, so we don't notice that. This is a slogan. Royal Society in 1663.
Is there a first fact?
the first fact, in many ways, is a very bad fact. Kenelm Digby publishes a little text in which he says, it is a fact that there is an ointment which, if you put on a dagger, will cure the wound of someone who's been stabbed with that dagger. And this is a fact that we know from experience, and it's a mysterious process, but it's like magnetism, it's action over a distance, which Aristotelian said was impossible. And this is a fact. And this is one of the first usages in English. Kenelm Digby is a member of the Royal Society, a founding member of the Royal Society. And in the years around then, the key example of the fact is what's called the weapon salve, this ointment you stick on a dagger to cure somebody who's been injured in a duel or something like that. It's a very bad fact. And within a few year or two, people start saying, well, I'm sure lots of people who get stabbed get better without the weapon salve. And I just think this, the evidence here isn't very, I'm using the word evidence, which they don't, evidence here isn't very reliable. That fact dies. But strangely, the word fact survives this unfortunate failure and becomes the key word.
Were people hijacking it as to give weight to an assertion, or did people genuinely believe it as something that they would, a word they would use for something that they believed had evidence to support it?
The modern terminology of science comes from two places. It comes from the law and it comes from astronomy. Fact, evidence, these are terms that come from the law. In the law, we talk now about an accessory after the fact, which just says, a Latin word for fact means a deed, an action. So an accessory after the fact is someone who's assisted someone after the committing of the crime. And the word fact normally means the crime. So lawyers try and establish the facts of the case. Straightforward. Facts are deeds. What happens is you take this legal term and you start talking about facts of nature, which nobody has done, but they've happened. They're objective realities. And the reason why you do it is, but in English law, once the jury has made a ruling about the facts, there is no appeal. Facts are definitively established. You can appeal on a question of law, you can't appeal on a question of fact. A fact is unquestionable. Mm. So the new science is claiming we can get things so right, there's no point in disputing them. And that's why the fact is for them a word, is a trump card. Once this is a fact, you're going to have to accept it and stop arguing about it. The other place, the key word here is theory. In astronomy, people have things they call theories. Theories are mathematical models for the movements of planets in the heavens. It's only in the 1660s that the word theory gets taken over and being applied outside astronomy. And the first time it's used in the title of a text is the publication of Newton's demonstration that white light is made up of coloured light, his famous prism experiments, when the Proceedings of the Royal Society, the editor, gives it the title Newton's New Theory of Light. Newton has never used the word theory himself, but he then picks it up, and Newton soon has a theory of gravity. And theories, I think, are fundamentally a new entity. Before that, people had had truths which were demonstrable because they were based upon logical deduction. With the idea of a theory, you've got something which you're saying, this works, it fits the facts, it explains what's going on, but of course we may find new facts, which we have to alter it. It introduces the whole idea of knowledge as being something that's defeasible, that can be improved, that can be worked on. Theories become things that you're never entirely satisfied with, and they're built into a notion of knowledge as progressive.
So they were happy with the idea that this knowledge was provisional?
Yes, I think they fundamentally are. And that's an extraordinary shift. And that's, I think, the cultural shift that makes science different from the world of Archimedes. Archimedes' knowledge is never provisional. Archimedes' knowledge is final. Terrible, terrifying moment for Galileo, I think, is when he discovers that Archimedes' principle only applies under certain limited circumstances and isn't a universal principle. And in that sense, you've got to correct, revise Archimedes' principle. And after that, I think Galileo's work doesn't catch on in this field. The work that really catches on is Pascal's experiments with vacuums, where everyone can see that something new has happened, and they debate about what its significance is, but they can see this is a fundamentally new type of understanding that's at work here. And from then on, scientific knowledge is understood to be provisional, and that's a culturally transformative moment.
Does the word proof come along, or is that much later?
In French, the word evidence doesn't exist. So the French in courts and in science never talk about evidence. All they have is proofs in the plural. So when we would say that you produce evidence to try and get a conviction, the French say you produce proofs to try and get a conviction. And I'm making this point in part because I'd assumed that evidence was a key word in the new science. The 17th century, they virtually don't use it. It's a late 18th, 19th century term in English. The new science in English and French doesn't talk about evidence. People like Boyle use the word proof in a French way and say, I've got proofs for what I'm arguing. But they also know that these are provisional proofs, and so they're uncomfortable with the word. So in a sense, what they're doing is taking proof and replacing it by theory or by hypothesis, which becomes the candidate theory, as it were. And so in part, an experimental science or an observational science starts to rely upon things that aren't proofs. And this is what, to go back to Gilbert earlier, when he says, I'm going to demonstrate to you that I'm right, and then he has to explain, but he says, by saying, I'm going to show it to you, I'm not going to prove it to you. And this is a different sort of knowledge from the old knowledge.
So other than giving them this sort of terminology to describe what they were doing or what they were trying to doing, I mean, does the language actually help the science progress, or is it more... Yeah, just a way of framing things. Does it help them work out what a methodology is, what replication is, and things like that?
I think that's a really deep question and a one that I puzzle over. I think it does. Leibniz thought that if you improved mathematical notation, it would transform maths in the way that the telescope would transform physics. And I think that once you've got the language of fact and theory, then you've got a new way of understanding what it is you're doing. The French will not accept Newton. It takes about 50 years for the French to accept Newton. One reason why the French will not accept Newton is because Newton's theory of gravity contains no demonstrations or proofs that this is how the world has to be. And it requires you to believe something that the French find impossible, that there can be action over a distance, that gravity can act over an intervening space. So the French say this isn't knowledge, because it's not demonstration. For Newton, it can pass as knowledge because he's moved into a world where you can understand something without fully understanding it. You can say, I don't know what gravity is. Newton says this all the time. I have no idea what it is. I know that it's there. And in that sense, this notion that you can have an incomplete but at the same time workable knowledge is a radically new notion. So I think the language makes possible that.
Tell us about the discovery of Tycho Brahe and how that was key in a lot of this.
There's a series of moments when classical knowledge begins to prove radically vulnerable. The first is the discovery that large areas of land are not confined to one hemisphere. All the medieval accounts of how the globe is organized require land to be in one hemisphere. It's clear that South America is partly in the other hemisphere from the old world. That's the first, with Amerigo Vespucci. The second is Tycho Brahe's discovery of the nova in 1572. Now, there's a sense in which this isn't an amazing discovery. The nova is a new star which ends up being so bright that you can see it in the daytime. It's brighter than Venus. Tycho Brahe and the astronomers of his time have no reliable record of anyone ever having seen a new star before. Aristotle and all of classical astronomy say there can be no change in the heavens. So this is an impossible event. And they then start debating, well, is it really in the heavens or is it in the upper atmosphere? Tycho Brahe produces all these wonderful arguments which show that it just cannot be this side of the sun or this side of the... And it has to be in the heavens. So this is the first great anomaly which shows that classical understanding doesn't work. It's a series then of profoundly important anomalies. Decisive one in many ways is Galileo's discovery of the phases of Venus, which show that because of a full set of Venus phases, that Venus is in orbit around the sun, which is impossible within classical Ptolemaic astronomy. And one of the things I'm happiest with in my book was I went off and counted editions of the classic texts of classical astronomy, which are Sacrobosco and people like that, the textbooks they'd use in universities. And you can show how through the 16th century, despite Copernicus, despite Tycho Brahe, they go on publishing these textbooks for students endlessly without any trouble at all, 30 editions every 10 years. After 1612, after Galileo discovers the phases of Venus, they're dead. The whole world has changed. Galileo never publishes a single work in which he says this is his most important discovery. He never publishes a book on this. He doesn't need to, because the moment people hear about it, they know the old astronomy is dead. So that's the second great anomaly. And the third great anomaly is the discovery of the vacuum through Torricelli's work with what we now call barometers. And once you've got those anomalies, you've got a realization that new evidence, as we call it, can destroy old knowledge. And you need to build a new form of knowledge that is robust against the acquisition of new information.
Why was the discovery of the vacuum so contentious?
Well, because Aristotle insisted there couldn't be such a thing as a vacuum.
There always had to be some kind of medium.
Yeah. I mean, Aristotle has no conception of space at all. Space can only be places that are there. He has no... And before the discovery of the vacuum, you get people sort of arguing about conceptually the possibility of abstract space and so on. But this is empty space. And according to Aristotle, it couldn't possibly, immediately things would crash together and fill the space. Impossible. And if there was empty space, it would be impossible to traverse it. It would be impenetrable. Mm. So in that, and this is Hobbes' great argument against the reality of a vacuum. He says light's going through it, so it can't be empty space. How can it be traversed? If it can be traversed, there must be something in there, some medium that the light is traveling through.
We're talking a lot about science, obviously, because it's a scientific revolution. But what about technology? Presumably, people could come up with technologies without understanding the science that may be at work in those. But where does technology fit?
If you live in Shakespeare's England, you have very few technologies that the ancient Romans hadn't had. You have clocks. You have the compass. You have the saddle and the stirrup. You have the printing press. These are all important, and the printing press particularly, I think, makes this, and the compass too, because it makes possible the voyages of Columbus, make the scientific revolution. But fundamentally, it's very clear to anyone in early 17th century Europe that the Romans are a more sophisticated civilization than anything they've got. Right into the 16th century, people are trying to catch up with Roman architecture, no notion of surpassing it. One of the things that's relatively new is the water wheel. But there are 6,000 water wheels in England in the year 10,000, in the Domesday Book, in the year 1,000. So that in that sense, technology between the year 1,000 and the year 1600 hardly moves. The great acceleration of technological change begins with the discovery of the steam engine. And one of the things I've tried to do in the book, it's a classic problem in the history of science and technology, did the new science contribute to the invention of the steam engine? And there's a series of classic texts which say, no, it didn't. These are two entirely separate things. They're separated by a long period of time. I've tried to establish how Newcomen, who builds the first really functioning steam engine, must have acquired the knowledge that he needed to make it. And he can only have got that knowledge, I think, from a man called Denis Papin. And Papin was a collaborator and assistant of Robert Boyle and of a great scientist called Huygens, and was himself a medical doctor and a professor of mathematics. And French have always said Papin invented the steam engine, and they're right. You can't build Newcomen's steam engine unless you understand that as you scale it up, it'll get better. Because if you build a small model, it's just a lousy piece of equipment. Newcomen has to start knowing that it's going to work better and better the bigger it gets, because otherwise you wouldn't invest the time and trouble to. Papin explains these scaling problems in such a way that once you've got that, you can see how to apply Boyle's law, expansion of gases, and get a working motor out of it.
That would have enough power to be of some kind of use. Or right.
People tease Papin. He says, my friends are saying to me, I'm going to be trying to invent an aeroplane. And he actually does try and invent a tank, a steam-driven tank. I mean, he really has a sense that military technology can be transformed by the application of this new. But all he actually does is build a little model that runs around his floor. Newcomen builds something that pumps out the water out of mines and begins the process of industrial revolution.
I wanted to ask you a bit about how maths fits into this, because, you know, over time, people have talked about maths being the language of nature. And I'm wondering whether some of these early scientists were really seizing upon that point.
Yes, Galileo is the first person to say that nature, the book of nature, is written in the language of mathematics. And he's very clear, actually, by mathematics, he means geometry. And all of the early scientists who are important are mathematicians, with hardly an exception. And when you look closely at the exceptions, Gilbert is a doctor, but he turns out to have set maths exams when he was in Cambridge. He's a mathematician as well. They're all mathematicians. Now, this is partly about professional rivalry. Natural science, as it was called, was taught by philosophers. And it was taught out of the textbooks of Aristotle, and you lectured on it by getting people to read Aristotle. The mathematicians had been denigrated by Aristotelian philosophers, and they what was always argued was that maths doesn't tell you about the real world, it tells you about theoretical possibilities. Philosophy tells you about the real world. Leonardo da Vinci is one of the first people to say that the knowledge of the philosophers is absolutely useless because it's not based upon experience, and knowledge which is based upon experience is the real knowledge, and all of that knowledge is mathematical. And what the mathematicians want to claim is that applied knowledge is also mathematical knowledge. And this is true for a whole series of activities like navigation. So applied useful knowledge becomes the speciality of the mathematicians, and the mathematicians set out to show how they can interpret the world in mathematical terms. And in many ways, the place I think where this book starts is with perspective painting, which is a mathematical construction. And once you've got the notion of the abstract mathematical principles that underlie perspective representation and making three dimensions into two, you understand that there are certain things you can only do if you understand geometry. And perspective painting is the first great application of maths to the interpretation of the world. And right through, a lot of the important mathematicians are also teaching perspective painting and have friends who are painters. Galileo has lots of friends who are painters, and he is taught maths by somebody who also teaches artists. So it starts, I think, in a way, with the invention of perspective at the beginning of the 15th century. That's one of the first great applications of mathematical knowledge. And then the claim becomes, well, actually, maths not only helps you interpret the world, it helps you understand what the world really is.
So, David, you've been talking about the stability of science. Are we always going to have this science forevermore?
That's a question that gives me a good deal of anxiety. Part of the argument of the book is that what makes science possible is the printing press. The printing press creates an enormous flood of new information. And with that, it becomes possible to question and dispute authority in a way that you can't. If you go and hear a lecture, you read a book, you can start scribbling in the margins. If you go and hear a lecture, you have to shut up and listen. And in that sense, books change your relationship to authority. And one of the simple terms here is the word author, which right into the 16th and 17th century means an authority. Shakespeare's never called an author in his life because he's not an authority until he's after he's dead. Suddenly, people start talking about authors as being people who say new things and are innovating, a word that means something quite new because it used to mean renovating. So I want to argue that this process of testing and questioning, it's partly about experiments, but it's also about having libraries of information to turn to. Gilbert begins his great book on magnets in 1600 by saying, I'm going to tell you what everybody knows about magnets so far. And he reviews I think it's the very first literature review. He reviews the complete literature. And he can do that because it's all now in print. Vesalius begins his great work on anatomy having first printed Galen for the first time, so that you can say, we now know what Galen thought, now we're going to show where he was wrong. In order to make progress, you have to have a baseline. And the baseline means you have to be able to access a large pool of information. And in that sense, the printing press creates critical learning. And the fact I want to argue is a reflection in epistemology, you might say, of the reality of printing. You can test facts because you can check them in other sources. We're living in a post-print age. We're moving into a post-print age. We're moving into a digital age. And we are facing a whole new tidal wave of information. Gilbert talks about being at sea with all the information he's got. We're absolutely at sea with the information. And the new information we've got, I think, is printing books stand still. They don't change. Web pages alter and revise, and they don't stand the same. So I think the very nature of knowledge will change. I think the fact and the notion of a science which is reliable and stably grounded in pieces of information is in part the product of the printing press, which provides you with reliable, stable, grounded pieces of information. I don't think we know how our understanding of what knowledge is going to alter in the digital age. But if I'm right that the printing press makes science possible, then I think it's a real question of whether we can preserve those ways of thinking and that sense of reliability and accuracy and testability within the flexibility of the digital age. And I think in that sense, it's worth asking, are the mental habits and tools that are necessary for science actually under threat within a digital age? And how do we need to ensure that they're preserved within the flexibility, the alterability, the sort of chameleon-like qualities of the digital world? So it may be better science will come out of all this, but I do think there's a real possibility that habits of thought and traditions of thought that have actually made science possible will be endangered by it.
A big thank you to David Wharton. The Invention of Science, A New History of the Scientific Revolution is published by Allen Lane and available now. And if you're listening on Monday, the 21st of September, you can join me for a special Guardian Live event in London to explore the future of human spaceflight and the discoveries made by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft after its 3 billion-mile journey to Pluto. Joining me will be Kevin Fong, Chris Lintott, and Monica Grady. For details and to buy tickets, go to theguardian.com/guardianlive. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to David Wharton. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.